Oh, for the days when people traveled by train. The scenery, the comfort, the luxury, the smuggling, the murders, the crashes. Sounds like it's time for episode 96 of Pop Art, where we find the pop culture in art and the art in pop culture. It's the podcast where my guest chooses a movie from popular culture, and I'll select a film from the more art classic indie foreign side of cinema with a connection to it. I am your Yura Diesel host, Howard Kass. Today, I am happy to welcome back as my guest, screenwriter Jordan Trippier, who has chosen as her film the action-packed Brad Pitt-led comedy, Bullet Train, while I have chosen the more indie, Woody Harrelson, Emily Mortimer crime drama, Trans-Siberian, both films about criminal goings on a train. Before beginning, I do want to encourage my listeners to follow, like, or comment on the podcast. I want to know what you think. So to begin, Jordan, why don't you remind our audience something about yourself?
Hi, everyone. My name is Jordan Trippier, and I am a produced screenwriter, soon to be novelist, who loves all things weird, wonderful, and bizarre. And I consider Bullet Train part of that as well.
Yes, I can see that. Well, great. With that, let's get to your selection, and that is Bullet Train. First, some information about the film. Bullet Train is an American action comedy released in 2022. It was directed by David Leitch and written by Zach Olkowitz, based on the 2010 novel Maria Beadle by Kotaro Isaka. It stars Brad Pitt, Joey King, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, Brian Tyree Henry, Andrew Koji, Hiroyuki Sanada, Michael Shannon, Benito A. Martinez Ocasio, or Bad Bunny, as he is better known, Sandra Bullock, Zazie Beetz, Logan Lerman, Masi Oka, Karen Fukuhara, with uncredited appearances by Channing Tatum and Ryan Reynolds. Ladybug is a criminal operative who only does snatch and grab. He is assigned to retrieve a briefcase on a bullet train that runs from Tokyo to Kyoto and then get off at the first stop. He quickly finds the briefcase but is unable to get off as he finds himself embroiled with a large number of criminals and hired guns, all after the same thing. He only has until the end of the line to resolve everything. Before beginning, I thought we might talk about one of my favorite subgenre of films, and that are stories, especially thrillers and mysteries that take place aboard trains. What do you think is the appeal of movies like this?
We always talk in screenwriting about urgency and about the why now and about how you are supposed to trap your characters in these sort of larger-than-life or dangerous circumstances. Nothing more perfect for that than trapping them in a space that they can't escape without seriously injuring themselves, that forces them into constant conflict with the people that either want the same thing they do or are trying to catch them or trying to keep away from them. There's just something really fun about it, but it also plays a really big story part, which is that it forces them into constant conflict. And I think people really respond to that because it's the natural thing in storytelling that draws us to it. Whether it's a sweeping epic or a tiny, tiny indie, it doesn't really matter because we naturally understand the discomfort and the frustration and the claustrophobic feeling of not being able to escape our circumstances.
I think you've really hit it on the head in many areas. As you intimate, there is like this automatic ticking time bomb in a way. Everything has to be resolved by the time the train arrives at its terminus. And you're right about the claustrophobia, because trains are both a restricted set and not a restricted set. For stories that take place on a train, it is only one location. At the same time, it's a very large location. You can move from car to car, so you're not stuck in just one place. And then the train will occasionally stop at stations, which can allow as well for changes in tension. And if you compare that to planes, where you can't ever leave the plane, plane journeys tend not to be as long as train journeys. It is very claustrophobic, but it's so claustrophobic that you don't have a lot of elasticity and variety in plotting. There's only so many places to go on a plane. But on a train, you might have 3, 4, 5, 10, 20 cars to go between. You know, buses are also claustrophobic, but they frequently stop, and it would be hard to keep a story going on a bus ride when it would probably be resolved at the first stop in some way. Cars tend to be road movies. I'm very hit and miss on this. The closest to trains are ships, and I don't think they're used as backdrops enough. This week, I was on another podcast, the Lambcast, and I mentioned this upcoming episode And host Richard also loves train movies, and he always goes to the TCM Film Festival every year. When I mentioned I would love a film fest of train films, he had a great idea. Have a film festival on a train and show nothing but train films with the train going from one destination to another, have it over a few days. But today, people in the U.S. don't take trains like they used to. In Silver Streak, they had to come up with some excuse for Gene Wilder's character to take a train that everyone would believe. But in Europe and Asia, more people take trains. It's a more important method of transportation. Everybody does it. Though in Trans-Siberian, they do explain why the central carriage is taking the train instead of flying. It's because the husband is a train nut. But they don't need that excuse in bullet train. I mean, why would one fly from Tokyo to Kyoto? Yeah.
I think all of these transportation films, they have different spirits, which is really special about them. There's this feeling that with each one of them, you're going to get a different ambiance, a different rhythm to the storytelling. And it's why a film that takes place in a car, a road trip movie, feels so different from a train movie, different from a ship movie. And I agree with you. I think there are not enough ship movies. I was thinking about this earlier today. There is a style, there is an atmosphere to it that you can't match anywhere else.
Why did you choose this film?
Bullet Train was my second favorite movie of 2022. It's very fun. And at the time, that's what I was looking for. I greatly enjoyed my experience in the theater, but I also think that the story itself is really well done for how many characters you're keeping track of, how many different story threads are happening. I've heard from people that they thought it was quite convoluted. I didn't have that problem. I adored it. Every single time a new thread was introduced, I kind of gave myself a little break and said, okay, let's see how this plays out. Love Bird idea of introduce characters by flipping the script several times on who we think we're actually going to be following throughout the story. I think personally, I don't know that there's necessarily a word for this type of movie. I just kind of use the word irreverent. It's this idea that even though violent things are happening, even though the danger would be quite serious, there's a very easy case to be made that with films like this, there would be huge consequences. You know, the train crashes at the end, people would be dead and all these things, but it misses the fundamental point of the story, which is that it's not real life. It's an exaggeration of a situation that is taken to its breaking point and made very fun along the way. I've always loved those sensational action movies, not quite comedies, not quite dramas. It's almost like a live action cartoon. Characters I genuinely enjoyed. I would watch them again and again. And I'd love a prequel of Tangerine and Lemon's story.
When you talk about the convoluted plot, which I also didn't find convoluted. I probably couldn't tell you the plot after seeing it, but it all makes perfectly sense as it went along. The structure is basically a farce. And one of the definitions of a farce is the last person you ever want to enter a room is always the person that enters the room. And it's just a variation on that. When did you first see it? Well, let's face it, you saw it in 2022, probably on its opening.
I saw it the first day. I saw it that Friday.
I first saw it when it opened as well. So I'm sure I saw it on the Friday it opened because the following Sunday, I was on a podcast, the Lambcast, where we talked about it. So I've actually already talked about this movie quite a bit before. I also loved it. It was one of my favorite films of the year. I thought it was very clever and smart, very hipsterish and postmodern, and does delve into some existential issues concerning fate, luck, and destiny, and how much control we have over them. At the same time, you might not want to put too much thought into it and just have a great time. This is going to be a difficult question, I think. What are some of your favorite scenes?
There are certain things.
One great scene after another, but
that's the lovely thing about the movie to me is that it constantly surprised me. Where it could have been such a straightforward story, every scene sort of unfolded in an unexpected way, even if it was true to trope, true to genre. There were only a few scenes where I was like, okay, I've seen this before. And I love, absolutely adore Hiroyuki Sanada. I think every scene he was in, he elevated so much. His small, tiny storyline and the fact that they were able to satisfy an arc within the story itself, like 20 years previous, is lovely. I really enjoyed every scene with Tangerine and Lemon, like I've said. I think Joey King did a phenomenal job. I don't know the actor's name, but the actor who plays the father, he did a fantastic...
Andrew Koji, Richie Kimura, the father.
I think they played against each other very, very well. I think Brad, when he plays to the absurdity of life when his character is not a hyper-masculine stereotype. Those are the roles that I really enjoy from him. Trying to think of a scene in particular that I could identify as my favorite. I really appreciated the stylistic choices they chose when it came to Michael Shannon's character. They did a fantastic job of just whispering his name all the way through the story to the point where every little piece of story that you hear about him adds up to that flashback in which we see how he took over that specific branch of the Yakuza. And it's a short scene. It's very stylistic. The time stretch, the music is loud, rain's falling, the mask is on his face. I love that scene just because it does so much storytelling with no additional explanation required. It's the same thing with Bad Bunny, the wolf. When I was sitting in the theater watching it for the first time, when that scene came on, I was like, this is a very long introduction for this character. We haven't even seen in action yet. And then, spoiler alert, they kill him almost immediately. I was like, that's such a fantastic misdirect. And then he ultimately isn't important, which is just wonderful. It speaks to the spirit of the luck, fate, and destiny, and this idea that all of these characters from very, very different parts of the world have converged on this train, and most of them aren't getting off.
So actually, I think that's a profound way of putting it, which we'll come back to when we later talk about the themes. Yes, there's from all over the world, and some of them aren't getting off, or actually they're getting off in a different way. I have a few favorite scenes too. They're very small because it is one good scene after the other. I loved it, and I think the audience loved it, when he hit the My Kitty doll.
Yes.
Which should be noted, My Kitty is not a cat. It's a little girl. I like the Channing Tatum scene. Those were very, very clever and very funny. And I think there's one scene that I think is extremely clever and I think shows the cleverness of the screenplay. The Joy tells Kimura he has to find the combination of the briefcase. He says that's impossible. There are too many combinations and he can't do it. And she says, yes, you can. And he does, going one number at a time. After all, there are only 999 possibilities. Then when Ladybug and Tangerine get off the train with a fake briefcase, and Ladybug just spins the locked numbers, and it just hits the right combination, and the briefcase opens, that wouldn't work or be as funny without that first scene.
Yes, I agree.
This movie has a lot of these wheels within wheels.
They even pay off that scene later when you get the two henchmen who are about to open the case and die in the explosion that Little Prince has put in there for her father. That's also a payoff of that mini arc. And just to sort of double down on it, they do that again, both with the flower that Hiroyuki Sanada carries around, as well as with the water bottle. Now, the water bottle is the most overt of all of those objects, getting their own little storylines.
The director is David Leitch. As a director, he's relatively new, as many of the people we talk about today are. He is credited with only 4 features. He also did uncredited work on John Wick. I've only seen 2 of his films, Deadpool 2 and this one, but he's also done Atomic Blonde and Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw. How do you feel about David Leitch as a director? Have you seen many of his films?
Seen all 4 of Leitch's films, actually. I adore Atomic Blonde. I think Atomic Blonde is absolutely fantastic. It's worth watching. It's not as clean as this movie is, but the action in Atomic Blonde is absolutely worth the watch. I also really appreciate it because they do something with, it's a common trope in action movies where the characters never get tired. And in Atomic Blonde, that's the exact opposite of what happens. There's an entire fight where she gets exhausted. And I like that addition of realism to action. I'm very excited to see what he does next.
What I'm going to say is going to sound a little like a negative, and I don't mean this pejoratively, but he does seem to be what I call a traffic cop director. He has to keep everything going like a traffic cop at an intersection. And he's really good at that, maybe even transcendent at that. Because usually when I say a director is a traffic cop on a movie, I just mean that's all he brings to it. David Leitch, I think, brings a lot more to it than being a traffic cop, but he's a really good traffic cop. He's a top-notch director of pop culture film. Knows how to do postmodern action movies with more than a bit of snark connected to them. Knows how to make them look good. And that's perhaps not surprising because he's credited on about 82 films for stunts and fight and action choreography. And in this movie, though he excels at the action sequences, they sometimes have the wit and grace of a Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers dance number. It's obviously he's influenced by Jackie Chan, and I always call Jackie Chan the Fred Astaire of the martial art film. And sometimes I think this movie is like a musical, but with action scenes instead of musical numbers.
I would agree with you. I think, though, it comes down to fight choreography. It's the idea that he wants you to be impressed and appreciate fighting itself. And that's, I think, what you're referring to when you talk about musicals, is that when you watch a musical, it's usually not just someone standing there singing at you. They're dancing, they're moving, their body language is telling part of the story, what they're singing. But it's the combination of all of those pieces choreographed carefully together that allows it to rise above the sum of its parts. And here, you're absolutely right. There's beautiful choreography, not just in the actual structure of the story, but in the fight scenes between individual characters. I am not a fan of shaky cam fighting. Jason Bourne, I enjoy, but it's not my favorite style of shooting.
But it's unclear now, I think, whether Leitch will transcend this and make films that are more personal in order to enter the pantheon of the great directors. There's no really requirement that he does so. But he does have a style that feels very him, and perhaps he will go in that direction. The screenplay is by Zach Olkowitz. I really couldn't find out a lot of information about him. This is his only feature, though he has one in post-production that looks interesting. He has writing credits on The Last Voyage of the Demeter, which is about the ship that brought Dracula to England. So we get to see what happens on that ship during the voyage.
Cool.
It's a marvelous script, but it's not always easy to see how much credit to give to Olkowitz and how much to give to Leitch and to the original author, Sokka. How did you feel about the screenplay?
Well, I haven't read it yet, although I would love to. To be honest, I think it's a dream of a lot of screenwriters to be able to pull off an ensemble piece like this. And there are a lot of scripts that do not succeed at carrying multiple threads at once in a clear and enjoyable way to read. I think that he was spectacular at telling like 5-6 different stories at once, and almost all of them succeed. There's only one that I think was robbed of depth. The one part of the story that I'm sure they cut, I'm sure there's a ton of extra stuff, and maybe when they do like a director's cut or a DVD commentary or something, they'll talk about it. But it's the boom slang killer. The boom slang killer, Zazie Beetz character.
Oh, right.
She doesn't get very much screen time. She doesn't get very much development. She's sort of played off as a laugh in a single. She's there throughout. We find out, of course, when they reveal what she's been up to on the train and what she was up to in Mexico. But the actual scene where she fights Brad Pitt and dies is not the best example of what could have been done with that character.
It's easy to see the influence of Pulp Fiction here, not just in the snarky dark comedy. There's a character named The Wolf. There are two thugs, one black, one white, who go on and on about triviality in a normal conversational way while doing these horrible things. It's very postmodern with its references to pop culture like Hello Kitty and Thomas the Tank Engine and Eastern spirituality. And the structure with the flashbacks feels very Tarantino-ish. In its original developed stage, it was a serious drama. But along the way, and I say thank God, it became more of an action comedy. What do you think are some of the ideas or themes here?
Of course, there are the big marquee themes, which is, you know, the discussion of fate versus luck, as well as family. They keep echoing this idea of loss, which is that everything begins because of a loss. White Death winds down into all these other characters eventually losing their lives because that one loss sealed their fate, so to speak, in his mind anyway. And then on top of that, you have losses all the way through the story of Logan Lerman's character, where he there one moment, gone the next, the victim of a drive-by snake venom. And then you also have the Tangerine and Lemon. When Tangerine dies, that's the saddest scene in the entire movie. You've spent time with these characters, you've come to love them, and they make up the heart of the movie. There's also the loss of Wataru at the beginning, which sets off everything as well on the opposite side. So the fateful final encounter between the White Death destroyed Sonata's family, took away his livelihood, and has now resulted in his grandson being pushed from a roof. It's all loss.
I think you make a lot of good points there, and especially when talking about fate and destiny. I think it's very existential because it puts all these people in a world that is to some degree meaningless. I mean, it's very amoral. There really is no such thing as right and wrong. And the characters all have to make choices or have made choices about who they are. And Ladybug is still struggling with how to face this world or what choices to make about himself in this world, and is taking a more Eastern spirituality to it and is trying that. But in the end, most make choices that are based on relationship. And you mentioned this. They all have a law. This is where morality is based in their world, being true to those you have formed a relationship with or are related to. While the White Death has no morality when it comes to relationships and family, the elder, Yuichi's father, does. And their lives indifferently. He lives, the White Death doesn't. In fact, the White Death's family completely gets wiped out while the elder's family stays intact. I thought it was also ironic that the prince considers himself lucky and Lady Bird considers herself unlucky. I think if you look carefully at it, by the end, they both seem to face equal amounts of bad and good luck. So
yeah, it's the perspective, right? It's right. The idea of the lie you tell yourself is leeching out into the world and how you interact.
Yeah, if you consider yourself lucky, you'll emphasize the things that happen to you. If you consider yourself unlucky, you'll emphasize the things that happen to you that are not fortuitous. And if you consider yourself lucky, you'll emphasize the things that are fortuitous. Like you said, it's all perspective. But in the end, no one really has much control over their lives here. It's all chaos and luck and having to think on one's feet and improvise. And they've all sort of accepted this. They've made an existential choice to accept that it's all meaningless and amoral and chaotic. Matt Solar Site had an interesting comment in his review on RogerEbert.com, where he says, Bullet Train is at its best when it's a comedy about self-styled badasses who think they are free agents, but are all just passengers on a train rocketing from one station to another. And you mentioned something like this about all these people gathering on this one train from everywhere. And I think that's an interesting metaphor for life, that we all come into this earth, which is that train, and eventually we all have to leave it. And it's all just chaos and meaninglessness, and we have to make these choices. So I think there is a very interesting metaphor about life in this story.
Well, what's also interesting too, I like what he says about it's sort of arbitrary rocketing from one place to another. I think one way to tell whether a story is actually successful is the emotional complication that the audience experiences when things happen. If your story is too simplistic, the audience has only two options, right? They have the option to lean into the decision the characters made because they understand why the characters made it, or lean out and be like, oh, they made the wrong choice, whatever. But here you have a lovely scene, for example, when Tangerine dies. He dies because Ladybug kills him trying to protect Little Prince. Ladybug doesn't know that Little Prince is using him or taking advantage or is in fact a diesel, as Lemon says, but he still protects her because why wouldn't you? There's a universal understanding that when you see someone smaller, weaker being harmed, there is an expectation that you will stand up for them, which also echoes the same thing that happened with Wataru, right? Where the elder, the first thing he asks his son is like, where were you? You should have been here. This is your only job to protect your child. And it's not a direct echo, but the fact that he'll Tangerine, to me, a beloved character, one that is very easy to like, even if it's only in relation to Lemon and how much he genuinely cares about Lemon, you don't hate Brad Pitt. You don't hate Ladybug because he kills him. You feel sad. You're saddened by the loss of Tangerine, but the arbitrary nature of his death both fits into the story and doesn't take away from your appreciation of Ladybug's journey or what he will be called upon to do at any given time.
Some of the more notable changes from the book. I haven't read the book. This is what I understand. The character of the White Death does not appear in the novel. In the novel, it is Mini Gishi's son who Tantrine and Lemon are trying to transport back to his father. The prince is male and 14 years old. His and Kimura's appearance on the train is not connected with everything else that goes on. Ladybug's name is Nanao, N-A-N-A-O. Lemon dies instead of Tangerine. The hostess is the Hornet, not the woman in the Hello Kitty costume. And the train doesn't crash at the end of the novel.
Interesting.
Yeah. Without reading the novel, I really couldn't pass judgment on that. But it sounds like some of these were very good decisions to make in adapting.
The one that interests me the most is the fact that they're transporting Minagishi's son. Because Minagishi is the Yakuza boss who has been dethroned.
I thought that was it, but I just really couldn't confirm it.
But that's an interesting change because almost everything that they're doing on the train, at least Lemon and Tangerine, is
now revolves around white death sucks. We also have to talk about the problematic aspect of the movie. We discussed this in the Limecast broadcast as well. The movie Marvel was accused of whitewashing by many, especially in casting Brad Pitt and Joy King. David Inouye, executive director of the Japanese American Citizens League, said he would have accepted the casting if the story had been moved to the U.S. and pushed back at any excuse that Asian actors couldn't carry a blockbuster by mentioning such films as Crazy Rich Asians and Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Ring. Eric Francisco of Inverse wrote, "Unless you saw the individual character posters, you'd be unlikely to think Bullet Train actually stars any Asian talent. Hollywood supposedly doesn't cast Asian leads because they aren't stars, but the truth is they aren't stars because Hollywood isn't cast Asian lead." Izaka, though, who wrote the book, pushed back and said the characters are, quote, "ethnically malleable," unquote, maintaining that his original Japanese setting and context were irrelevant, as they were, quote, "not real people, maybe they're not even Japanese," quote. And if we get back to Eric Francisco, he also noted that Isaka and most Asian audiences, quote, "enjoy their own domestic film industry and go to Hollywood for the spectacle of foreigners." How do you feel about this aspect of the film?
Well, that brings up an interesting question, because the author is sort of in a tough spot how right. he has to answer that question. Right. The film industry, particularly, no matter where you are, but particularly in Hollywood, can be quite vindictive. And so he wants to do well because it represents his storytelling. He wants it to do well because it's been probably years and it was probably a dream of theirs to have this done. Right. But I would argue that I've heard similar perspective on story from creators of all different colors. So the idea being that characters are interchangeable for race, particularly in a story like this, which is almost elevated to the point of a parable. He says it's not real life. No one acts like this in the real world. It's an interesting problem to have because we are seeing a renaissance of Asia now, right? And so the idea of putting an actor that we may not recognize in the role isn't as much of an excuse anymore as it once was. Really what matters is the story well told? And then could it have been equally well told with anyone in those places? I don't have that. So I don't know necessarily about the whitewashing, because to me it feels like it could have put a number of really talented acquisitions and it would have probably still been just as entertaining. However, I've heard from particularly international creators who say that when they get involved with Hollywood, they're partially doing it to see these big actors, these big people take the roles. They want the prestige and the joy of seeing people that they watched when they were kids get roles. We're not to the point yet, we should be, but we're not to the point yet where it's a truly international industry.
Usually when this subject comes up, I think it's pretty much cut and dry. The idea of not using Asian actors in certain parts where the parts were originally Asian is, to me, obviously racist and a big mistake. But here, there's something interesting because they expanded the diversity of the cast to not just include Asian, but to include Latinx characters, Black characters. They made a male character into a female character. So they actually increased the diversity in the cast. So this is where it gets a little not so clear in a movie like this, because I think a lot of people who might be ethnically like Latinx or Black would say, wait a minute, these people are cast when they usually wouldn't get cast in parts like this.
That's a great point. Most stories, I personally believe, are improved by just treating the characters and finding the best person role, no matter who they are.
I agree generally with what you're saying. My only problem is when someone says we need the best person for the role, there is no such thing.
That's true. That's when the business side of it is really right. Where you have to look for the answers there.
Let's give a quick shout out to the cinematography and the editing. Jonathan Seale is a cinematographer. He's done most, if not all, Leitch's films. And Elizabeth Ronald's daughter, she's also worked with Leitch as well. They're both mainly known for action movies. They certainly have found their niche, and I think they work very well within Leitch's. And the art set decorators do a very good job of hiding the fact that the movie was not filmed in Japan, but on LA sound stages. The music was by Dominique Lewis. I think it's a perfectly fine score. It's a very standard score for an action film. But the real aspect to talk about is the song. And here we get very hipsterish. Hipsterism uses an alternative pop culture. It's still pop culture, but not necessarily the most popular pop culture. But it's the pop culture outside of mainstream pop culture. And song choices are one area where this happens a lot. So do you have a favorite song or use of a song in this movie?
It's the song that plays when the White Death is rolling the gun down his arm. The sort of hard rock, heavy metal-ish kind of squealing voice. It's called A Modern Place. It looks like it was created by Dominic Lewis himself.
Is there a song there or is it just music?
It's a score.
Oh, yeah. So that would be part of his, right?
It was both deeply intimidating, but also fun. That I feel like is the nexus with this movie.
Well, I have two. One is 500 Miles, which is painfully nostalgic for me, which is sort of redundant because nostalgia by definition is painful. But I remember it from growing up in the 60s during the folk movement. And then Sukiyaki, which I was actually finally waiting for most of the movie. This was also a big hit in the 60s. It was written by Japanese songwriter Rokusuku Ii in 1961 under the title, I can't pronounce it, but it translates as Let's Go With Our Faces Up. It was his response to his participation in student protests against the ongoing U.S. military domination in Japan after World War II. But an Englishman bought the track on a visit to Japan and renamed it Sukiyaki after the Japanese dish just because it was easier to pronounce. It has nothing to do with the song. And it was actually sold as a man getting over the heartbreak of a love leaving him. It was one of the first songs to become hugely popular in the U.S. that wasn't in English. You don't know what the singer is singing about, but it's a beautiful song.
It's used in a really interesting way, playing over some, you know, not necessarily the most friendly.
Engelbert Humperdinck sings Forever Blowing Bubbles during the tally of Bollies, Bodies at the Believed Job, which is the anthem of the West Ham United FC in the UK. Tangerine has a West Ham United phone case. Song is used 3 times in the movie. But I also love hearing songs in foreign languages. So I love The Staying Alive and I loved Hero. I don't know why. There's just something about hearing it in a foreign language that does something to the song.
Yeah, absolutely.
It got mixed reviews. On the plus side, Richard Roper of the Chicago Sun-Times rated the film 3.5 out of 4 stars, calling it wildly entertaining and praised the performances, the creative and blood-spattered action sequences, and most of all, the writing. Peter DeBruge of Variety wrote, Bullet Train feels like it comes from the same brain as Snatch, wearing its pop style on its sleeve, a Kill Bill-like mix of martial arts, manga, and Gabby Hitman movie influences, minus the version of wit that implies. But to go back to Matt Zoller's sites, he says, it seems to want to have it both ways, telling us, quote, this is all light and silly, and none of it is of any consequence, unquote, and at the same time trying to whack us across the throat with a moment of dramatic power so that we cry for the character.
Well, I guess this might just be a difference of personality, but I don't think those things are mutually exclusive.
Good point. Well, with that, here is some more information about the movie. It cost around $90 million to make and made $239.3 million at the box office. The film's director, David Leitch, appears briefly as the 17th person killed, the one unintentionally, by Lemon and Tangerine, while rescuing the sun. Ryan Reynolds accepted the cameo as a thank you to Pitt for Pitt's own cameo in Deadpool 2. Sandra Bullock joined the following year in February to replace Lady Gaga, who dropped out due to scheduling conflicts with House of Gucci. During the fight scene in the snack bar, there's a bottle of Miravel wine on the counter behind Ladybug. Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie co-owned the Miravel winery and estate until she sold her share post-divorce in 2021. The fruit truck Lemon drives at the end of the movie is the same truck that almost hits Ladybug at the start of the movie. The combination for the briefcase is 807. 805 is shown it's not working, and the father needs 2 more tries afterwards, and he's increasing the numbers 1 by 1. And this was reportedly the first film made from the start under the COVID guidelines. I believe that's why it was made on sound stages and not on location. With that, let's get to my selection. However, before that, we're going to take a moment out here from a fellow podcaster.
Do you like podcasts? Do you like movies? Do you have opinions about films? Maybe you should be listening to The Lambcast, the official podcast of the large association of movie blogs, also known as The Lamb. With more than 2,000 members, The Lamb is the largest collection of movie bloggers on the web by sheer numbers. Every week on The Lambcast, a group of our members tries to pull the wool over your ears when we get together to talk about movie-related subjects. Sometimes we review new films. Sometimes we talk about older classics, and occasionally we go off in directions that the community just has to get off their chest. This weekly show has many themes that any movie buff can embrace. Don't be fleeced by an imitation. Find us at largeassmovieblogs.com or on Twitter, at The Lamb. On Facebook, you can find The Lamb and Lambcast for connections to our latest shows. Join the flock.
Welcome back. My selection is Trans-Siberian. For some information about the film, Trans-Siberian is a psychological thriller released in 2008. It was directed by Brad Anderson and written by Anderson and Will Conroy. It stars Woody Harrelson, Emily Mortimer, Ben Kingsley, Kate Mara, Eduardo Noriega, Thomas Kretschmann, and Etienne Choucault. A married couple returning from doing missionary work in Beijing decide to take the train to Moscow because the husband is fascinated by trains. On the way, they befriend another couple who seem friendly enough at first, but who soon get the married couple caught up in a fight between drug smugglers. How would you compare the films? How do you think they relate or are different? How well do you think they fit together?
Considering the first is an action comedy and the second is a psychological thriller, I feel like their similarities lie in the bamboozling of the characters in terms of the complications that arise for them as they're riding this train and, of course, the location of the train. The complication, though, I think the strongest connection.
They both have organized crime villains. The stakes here are very high, and in both cases, there's a certain time element involved for bullet train. It's reaching Kyoto and Trans-Siberian, it's reaching Moscow. They both have MacGuffin. In Bullet Train, it's the briefcase, and in Trans-Siberian, it's the Matryoshka dolls made of heroin. And the climaxes both revolve around a central character trying to take over and drive a train. But as you said, while Bullet Train is very tongue-in-cheek and a comedy, Trans-Siberian, of course, is much more serious, more down-earth, even earthy and edgy. The trains are very different. Bullet Train is sleek and the height of technology and luxury, while in Trans-Siberian, the train feels like it's been around the block or the tracks a few times. I even wonder just how accurate the portrayal of this train is, because Trans-Siberian is big on tourists. For some people, it's like a bucket list thing, except that from what I can tell, it is very claustrophobic. But Anderson says it was based on his experiences traveling on the Trans-Siberian as a youth, and so who knows what it was like in those days. And then, of course, there are thematic differences as well, which we'll delve into later. When did you first see the film?
I saw it thanks to you. You recommended it for this podcast, and so I took a couple hours, made some popcorn, and sat down to watch.
And what did you think of it? I know you said you had pet plot peeves with it, and I'd sort of like to wait on that until we get to discussing the screenplay. So maybe not be too specific here when it comes to that.
Overall, I liked that it felt like you were on the hip of the characters all the way through. There's very little time for you to sort of step back and take a breath. It all happens very quickly. I enjoyed that the culture was very different. They felt like they were out of their element. They felt like they didn't have a proper backbone of understanding, even with the language, even with the courtesies, the common little things that allow you to get by in a country. I love that they feel very much unprepared for it. It's a cliche at this point, a stereotype of idiot American who travels without really understanding what they're doing. But I appreciate that because it does happen. That's a real thing. There are plenty of people who get in over their head traveling, grounding it in that sort of experience where we don't know the culture when we're watching it unless we're from that culture. And then neither do the characters. It becomes this lovely commiseration with them as the story is going on that you would feel equally as put out by most of the things that happen to them along the way.
And you do mention that, I can't remember exactly how I phrased it, but these things do happen. And yes, we do hear reports of people sneaking things, drugs and other things into other people's luggage. That's why they ask you at the airport, has your luggage been out of your sight for any amount of time? Because these things do happen and you can really get caught. It's not quite the same thing, but we saw what happened with the basketball player recently in Russia when she got caught with something that we thought was over here incredibly trivial, but they treated it like it was a huge, huge deal. I saw it when it first came out. This is my third time, actually maybe my fourth time, because I think I've showed it to friends over the years since it came out. I thought it was one of the best films of that year. It's very tense. It looks very downbeat and somewhat neo-noirish. The acting is strong. What are some of your favorite scenes, or do you have some favorite scenes?
I like Woody Harrelson a lot. I think his character is really interesting. It's not one that he normally plays. It would actually be a really cool character to compare to his character from Triangle of Sadness in a different setting. But his character, I think, does a lot of the heavy lifting here in terms of grounding the story. Because even though he's very kind of hokey and Midwestern, you know, all my European friends, whenever you ask them, what are Americans like? They always say they're very loud, but they're very friendly. we get away with a lot because we're very friendly and willing to learn, especially when we are not on our own home turf. We're very open to you telling us stuff we should know. And this part could have come across very over the top if it had been with a lesser actor.
Some people would call him, there's a character from medieval times and it still shows up, called the Holy Fool. And he sort of fits in that category. And I think you're right. You don't usually see Woody Harrelson play this kind of normal person. And he did, to some degree, channel his role on Cheers in doing this part. So I certainly agree that Woody Harrelson does do, yes, a lot of heavy lifting.
I also really like the scenes when they're on the train trying to get around, because you mentioned that it was claustrophobic and very tight spaces and things like that. That was really intense for someone like me who's an introvert. I don't like being in crowds like that. I don't like feeling like I'm in a place where no one will help me if I need help. They do a very good job of setting up these small scenes, for example, with the initial tea woman on the train. And Woody Harrelson is trying to ask for directions and she doesn't understand him. So she just yells at him because she thinks he's demanding tea. A scene like that does a great deal of world build for you without us even having to understand what the problem is, because we know that there is a problem. You can't just go to the person who's working on board the train to ask for help if you're in a difficult situation, which adds to the level of atmosphere, but also to the deep sense of isolation that she ultimately feels when things start to go wrong for her.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I like the opening scene with Ben Kingsley. I think that sets up the situation well. I like the scene where the Russian, I think he was Russian, tells them about how the Russian police work, telling him the story about someone who finally was released after 2 weeks, but with two toes missing, and they think he's making up, and then he walks away with a limp. And I think that really helps set up why Jesse doesn't trust the police to tell them the truth about what's going on. And I think a lot of people feel that way if they're in a place like Russia, where they think they can trust the police. I also like the scene where Jesse is panicking and is trying to get rid of the doll. And I'm with her. I'm thinking there has to be an easy way to get rid of them, to get them off the train, but there just doesn't seem to be. The windows won't open. She's being watched when she gets off at a stop. I just feel that claustrophobic panic.
Yeah, I also thought of another one. I really enjoy the scene where Emily Mortimer and Kate Mara go to get food. Mm-hmm. It's such a small scene, but that felt so natural to me, this idea of these people coming together. That happens all the time. A lot of the reason people travel backpacking and so on is to have encounters with people where you can share food and drink and just get to know one another. There's another scene in the movie where they're sitting down and drinking with the group of Russian guys, Carlos, and then a man shows off his gulag tattoo on his arm. That I thought was really effective. And that also plays very well into Jesse's her photography hobby. That's exactly what all of these are. They're little snapshots. They're travel mementos that you carry with you.
I think you make an interesting point there with that scene between Jesse and Abby, because the same thing is happening in the scene at the same time with Roy and Carlos, where they're both telling these strangers intimate details of their life and are going, that only happens with strangers. You would never tell these to just anybody. But somehow you're in a foreign country with people you've never met before. You can tell them anything. You're never going to see them again. It's not going to come back to haunt you. And I agree. Those scenes I thought were very strong as well. The direction is by Brad Anderson. Are you a fan or familiar with his work? I've only seen three of his films. I've seen this one, Happy Accidents, and The Vanishing on 7th Street. And The Machinist has a big, strong cult following. So are you familiar with this work? And what do you think of him?
I've watched Beirut, The Machinist, and Session 9. So I have some work. You're the person who's introducing me to him as a name to recognize.
I think he's more of a cult favorite director. He's becoming more of a working director. He works a lot on TV now. I think he has the potential to break out as director, but his career so far hasn't been supporting it. And if he doesn't do it soon, he may end up just being a working director for his career. And my feeling is that his movies don't make money or enough money. The critics tend to like his film more than the audience do, though reviews can be mixed. But until he breaks through with something that makes money, he may be stuck where he is. But certainly the directing styles are different here. Anderson's film looks, they look gritty, edgy, downbeat, where Leisha's movies are bigger, full of color and space, looking very postmodern and pop culture-ish. And I like the visuals very much, and they are the handheld camera technique variety. It's not steady, it's shaky and jerky. And I have no issue with this approach, but I always find it ironic because this approach direction is done because it makes the story feel more naturalistic and realistic, in spite of the fact that that is not how we see real life. Our vision isn't shaky. It's very steady. This happens a lot in art where you have to do something unrealistic to it to make it feel more realistic.
Yeah, it's not about what actually is there. It's about how you concentrate and hype what is and is not there to elicit an emotional reaction.
And the shakiness also adds to the tension of the movie as well. And I also think here that the train does tend to rock a bit, and you see that in Bullet Train, it never does. Bullet trains tend not to. They're very state-of-the-art and very sleek. They tend not to rock like trains often do. So the screenplay is by Brett Anderson and Will Conroy. This is Will Conroy's, I think, only feature. So he's in the same basket as the author of our previous film, Bullet Train. So you have pet peeves. Here we go.
I looked it up before we started this. It turns out that Emily Mortimer agreed to be in the film 2 days before filming and hadn't had a chance to script yet. That is, I think, very obvious in the story. Because having worked as a creative executive now for a time, it does become a tad noticeable when it's male writers writing female characters that they don't have the experiences to think about certain situations and scenarios from the perspective of their female character. The issue that started creeping in as I was watching the movie is this feeling of a woman would never do that. A woman would never do that. A woman would never do that. And it's not overt. It's not so bad that it breaks the suspension of disbelief for me. You know, I still enjoyed the movie.
Well, go into that. What wouldn't a woman do, for example?
Going however many miles off a random place with a guy you don't know who's acting very creepy around.
Agreed.
Himself, that's not going to happen. There are women who, for whatever reason, are not smart enough to pick up on those cues,
but she is.
She is. Yeah, exactly. They introduce her as a character who has traveled extensively in her life, not only traveled, but been pulled into the darker parts of it, drug abuse and things like that, stealing. A woman like that knows better than to do that. There were also moments where I wish that they felt like they were actually thinking about how she would respond to these things, especially like when her husband gets off the train, right? He's lost. She comes back. You've got these two people you don't know saying, oh, okay, while you're waiting for him. To be honest, if that were me, you wouldn't have been able to drag me out of the hotel. I would have sat in the train station waiting for that train to arrive. That one is a little bit more believable, but it still struck me as this thing. Same thing with her letting him into her hotel room and just leaving the key behind to let him do whatever. Those things, they add up over time, and they take what is a very smart character and make her seem very unreliable in terms of what she performed.
The thing with the hotel room, which I thought was odd, is I think most people, no matter how naive or smart, as soon as he goes into the bathroom and he doesn't close the door, you would close the door.
Yeah.
I don't even know why she would leave the key for him. What does he even need the key for? He doesn't need to get into her room. If I were in that situation, I think, especially if I was a woman, I would say, okay, and I would have left the room. I would say, go ahead, take a shower. I'll be downstairs getting coffee.
Yeah.
So I do take your point. I think Emily Blunt does a rather good job of selling it in a way in that she's sort of caught between, is she going to go for God or Satan? You know?
Yeah.
And she's being very tempted by Satan in this case, or actually more Lucifer, because Ben Kingsley would be Satan. So Carlos would be a demon and her husband would be an angel.
There's a scene in the movie where she's sitting there and they're joking about her smoking as her one vice rather than drinking because she won't drink. And she says, be careful of eliminating all my, you know.
All of my demons, because you might get rid of my angels as well. I think also another area when it concerns women is that one of the through lines that they suggest is one of her conflicts is whether to have children or not.
Yeah.
And I tend to be a little tired of that. I think that's reductive of looking at women, that it has to be some kind of conflict like that.
I would agree. As a universal insert trope for female characters, it does get overused and it doesn't do anything. It doesn't add anything because we didn't start the movie wondering if they were going to have kids.
Exactly. How do you think the themes of the movies differ?
So you bring up the idea that it's the angel and devil and choosing between. I think that's fine That's a perfectly legitimate thing to have in your story. But I think that kind of took me out of the story a little bit was actually the theme. I don't know that I can necessarily pinpoint what the theme is in a way that doesn't make it sound a little bit terrible.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe tell me what you think the themes are, and then I can say whether they succeeded.
One of, I think, the biggest differences between the movies is that in Bullet Train, it's a world that has no morality, and any morality that it does have is based around relationships and such. But it's basically an amoral world. There really isn't good and evil. This is just the way these characters are. And they don't look to morality to justify how they act. But I think here, the backdrop does assume that there is good and evil. The central characters are Christian. They've been doing missionary work. And I think the Christianity portrayed here is very different than usual because these are good people. You know, they're not the far right. They don't seem to be evangelical fundamentalists. They drink, curse, and smoke. They're more Jimmy Carter than Billy Graham Jr. So when they make a decision based on morality, they believe that evil exists. They may get it wrong as to as good and evil, but they believe evil exists. And so they have to fight it and not succumb to it. When they're at the church, which is probably very symbolic here, Jesse is about to be seduced by the demon Carlos, and she resists him and then gets out from the church as part of it collapses. So I got it. Get it? Get the symbolism? Both are existential in that the central characters in both suddenly find themselves in a world that really makes no inherent sense. It's chaotic. It's not a world they're familiar with exactly. They have to decide what the meaning of their lives is going to be against that backdrop. Bullet Train tends to end existentially. The characters having made their choice of accepting and living a world that is essentially meaningless, and their lives don't really change, but they stay within the same chaotic, amoral, meaningless world. But in Trans-Siberian, the world does return to normal. So where Bullet Train is more influenced by the pop culture, post-postmodernism of Tarantino and the Coen, Trans-Siberian is more influenced by the modernist pre-existentialism of Alfred Hitchcock. And you can see his hand everywhere in this film. He could have made this film. And among the references that Brett Anderson drew on were the movies North by Northwest, Strangers on a Train, The Lady Vanishes, all of those Hitchcock, as well as Runaway Train, Dead Calm, and the book Crime and Punishment. I'm not quite sure the Crime and Punishment, but it is a book in which the central character thinks he is above morality, and it turns out in the book that no one is. So I think that's sort of the difference. One is in this world, amorality, and there is no such thing as good and bad, except perhaps thinking makes it so. And in Trans-Siberian, there is good and bad, has a very Christian approach.
That's a good point, because they have that scene at the beginning when we first meet them. The preacher is saying there's no such thing as a gray space. Everything is black and white when it comes to good and evil, right? Which is, in the wrong hands, a super extreme religious view.
Right.
Right. That's a good point to bring up, because you can kind of tell that hanging over the entire movie is this pressure. The moment you transgress at all, you are punished for it, even if you yourself are not responsible for it. Woody Harrelson gets off the train just to look at trains, and he gets left behind. He's not paying attention, didn't listen for the bell, he misses the train. It's not a bad punishment, but it is an immediate reaction. The world is responding to him, and Jesse has all of these scenes where she's tempted to do the wrong thing. And she keeps resisting until she finally doesn't. She's quote unquote saved at the last minute by a heavenly mess, but then also doomed by it because,
right,
you know,
she ends up killing the guy. He was trying to rape her and was attacking her, so.
Yes, exactly. But the
Carlos.
For sure. But the question is, would that have happened if no board had fallen and they'd, in the real world.
But
no
would it
board,
have happened if she hadn't gone off in the middle of nowhere with this guy who wasn't her husband?
That's true.
Sort of suspects isn't a good thing to do.
Right. You can't apply real world settings to the movie, because the movie is operating in a very constrained thematic space.
Manipulated. Both Bullet Train in this movie is manipulated to show off their theme, right?
Yeah.
You've talked about Woody Harrelson. I think he is very good, and Emily Blunt as well. But I have to say, Ben Kingsley, he is great.
He adds such gravitas to every movie he's in.
Yeah. As far as I know, his Russian accent is good. I'm not Russian. If I was Russian, I might say, it's not so good.
What's interesting to me, though, is that, like, if you told me he didn't get the script until a day before it started, I would also buy it. Not in a bad way, but in a way that he just naturally brings that Okay, I understand the part and I've come to play energy to every movie he's in. He's an interesting character, though, because I had to go back and look. I missed it in the first, the idea that he isn't who we initially think he is, right?
He is and he isn't. He is with the police, but he's corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which I found really interesting because I wish that I had been able to participate in that a tiny bit more throughout the story. Thematically, he's a really interesting character because he doesn't necessarily represent evil. He represents the black and white thinking that comes with good and evil and using it as a tool against people. For example, he himself never really tempts her to do anything, right? He asks her questions and she's the one who lies and he takes advantage of that. But he himself never goes around trying to get her to do anything she doesn't want to do, or even call her out. A friend arrives, like his quote-unquote partner slash goon who works for their boss. But it's the fact that he has the authority and then wields it to his own benefit that puts him on the dark side, and also asks a really interesting question about black and white morality as a concept.
Xavier Jimenez did the cinematography. I've only seen a couple of his films, and one, Intacto, I highly recommend. He works a lot. I think he does a good job here. He hasn't really broken out of the pack over here in the U.S., but in Spain, from what I can tell, he's a very well-respected cinematographer. I feel about the music about the same as I do for Bullet Train. It's fine. It's good to get jobs done. And I do want to point out the art set decoration. Like in Bullet Train, they do a very good job of making L.A. sound stages look like Japan. Here, I think they do a rather good job of making Lithuania look like Russia, because it was filmed in Lithuania.
Yeah.
Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times gave the film 3.5 out of 4 and praised the film, saying it builds true fear and suspense. S. Kurt Hunnicutt of the Hollywood Reporter wrote, "This vigorous, fast-paced tale that entwines plot with character and psychology, set against an incredibly exotic background, certainly has box office potential, as dynamic as its storytelling." Of course, this is ironic because it did not have box office potential because it didn't do that well. With that, here's some more information about the film. It cost $15 million to make and made $5.9 million at the box office. So not a ringing success, let us know. It did open the same weekend as The Dark Knight, which probably didn't help, but I would very put doubt that that is the reason it didn't do as well. The film was shot on location in Lithuania. The government gave the filmmakers 40 kilometers of track. Early in the movie, as the inspector checks the body, everything, as noted elsewhere, signals temperatures below freezing. Yet you hear the sounds of buzzing flies, which would not occur in that kind of cold. And the blood on the knife that's in the victim is not frozen. Roy and Jesse set out from Beijing and immediately deal with Russian staff on the train. In fact, the train would be manned by Chinese staff with the Chinese restaurant carriage whilst the train is still in China. The large map that Jesse studies in the movie says "all abroad" in very large letters instead of "all aboard." This is a reference to English language signs in China that sometimes have amusing mistakes in them. And when the main characters are in the car driving on the streets of Moscow, you can see a video ad of Double Coffee with a lake and a house in the background. It's a Latvian coffee house company operated in the Baltic states and Ukraine and not in Russia. With that, let's start closing out, and I asked you to choose a film or two to go with your movie that might interest our audience.
One are expecting. I think Train to Busan is absolutely wonderful and everyone should watch it. It's another great train movie. They do a fantastic job with it. Zombies and all are fantastic.
I should note, we covered that on Pop Art, combined it with a film called Flame Over India.
Also, I would recommend there's a HBO show that ran for only one season. It was produced, I believe, by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and it's called Run, and it stars Merritt Weaver and Donald Gleeson. I absolutely adore it. Not enough people watched it. It was very fun, very interesting. It's not the most complex story, and it's very dark comedy, but if you enjoy her other work, like Fleabag and Killing Eve, you'll probably get a lark out of that one, too.
Well, I've chosen 4 train movies, or perhaps 3, because I also chose Train to Busan. The Lady Vanishes is the 1938 Alfred Hitchcock film about a woman who befriends an older woman while she is taking the train back to England. When the older woman disappears, everyone denies she existed, and the woman is caught up in an espionage thriller. Of all the Basil Rathbone, Nigel Bruce, Sherlock Holmes films, 1946 Terror by Night is my favorite. Holmes is hired to protect a precious diamond while its owner returns home by train. But when her son dies and the diamond disappears, she turns to Holmes to solve the mystery. And 1952's The Narrow Margin is a cult favorite film noir about a police detective escorting the wife of a crime lord, is on trial to San Francisco. She's willing to testify against him, but she has to arrive there alive first. So what is next? What should we be expecting from you?
I have a film coming out next month. It's going to debut at the Sofia International Film Festival. It's called Scent of Linden. It's directed by Sissy Denkova. It's her first feature. It's a dramedy about the Bulgarian community in America. I also am working with a up-and-coming director named Naman Gupta on a feature version of his award-winning short film starring Karen Soni from Deadpool called Coming Out with the Help of a Time Machine. We've also just finished a script called Swarok, which is a folk horror movie that sort of combines The Exorcist with Indian folklore. And personally, another horror feature, a teen horror movie about Spin the Bottle, the party game. So lots of exciting stuff. And the plan this year is to finish a novel. So we'll see how that goes.
Well, that all sounds fantastic. I'll list my usual litany. I'm a screenwriter and script consultant, and you can find more information about that on my Howard Kastner screenplay consultation page on Facebook. My blog is called Rantings and Ravings, and there I explore issues on film and screenwriting. I have published 2 books of short stories on Amazon, The Starving Artist and Other Stories, and The Five Corporations and One True Religion. These are sci-fi, supernatural, and fantasy short stories. I have also published the second edition of my screenwriting book, More Rantings and Ravings of a Screenplay Reader. And I am an amateur photographer, and you can find those on Instagram. The previous episode was with podcaster and movie lover Nick Rehack, where we talked Looper and Predestination, 2 films about time travel with a Greek tragic overtone. The next episode will see the return of podcaster and filmmaker Derek Nguyen, where we will talk the musical Hair and Kurosawa's No Regrets for Our Youth, both about young people protesting the war. And with that, Jordan, I want to thank you very much for returning and being a guest on my show.
Thank you for having me.